Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Today I'm here with Willow Brew, who describes herself as an organic chat client, helping differently disciplined people get in touch. She's the co-founder and current board member of Jigsaw Renaissance, a learning and making community in Seattle, and co-founder and past director of Space Federation, which brings together hackers and makers spaces. Currently, Willow is the director of Geeks Without Bounds, which is an accelerator for humanitarian projects. Geeks Without Bounds was deployed with the FEMA innovation team for Hurricane Sandy. Welcome, Willow.
Hey, thanks. Hi.
And you're in Berlin currently.
Correct. Yes. Okay. I'm laid over until I go to Hamburg for Chaos Communications Congress.
Cool. Well, first, tell me about Geeks Without Bounds' involvement with FEMA innovation team with Hurricane Sandy. What was that about?
Sure thing. So the field innovation team was about how we can start to bridge different groups in figuring out what they need and having a better just response system in general. It was very much around a field response organizations and the NGOs and NPOs that are out there to help them often only support the official responders. And what we're finding is that is not a scalable approach. So if you only set up network for the first responders, the Office of Emergency Management, the police department, et cetera, they're better off, but they're still trying to deal with a massively messy situation. And so in refocusing away from them and onto your end user or the affected population, you allowed them an opportunity to organize themselves and to do a response that is appropriate for them.
Okay.
And does that make sense?
Sort of. What was your role? What did you accomplish there?
So my role was that because Geeks Without Bounds does so many hackathons of people trying to build technology for humanitarian and disaster response situations, and because we run this accelerator for 6 months, which provides mentorships and things like business development and human rights and security, we have a really high exposure rate to a lot of new and interesting tools that are out there, and also people who are technically adept at making what's out there work better. So when we deployed, it was to make sure that we were using the optimal solution in each situation, not necessarily what people had already bought into, not who they had contracts with, but what made the most sense at the time. And so because of that, tie into the entrepreneurship communities, into the makerspace communities, mesh networking, et cetera, it meant that I just had a huge repository of people that live in the Geeks Without Bounds institutional knowledge, I guess is how I put that.
Okay. And how did you deploy that? What was it? Could you give me an example of what, for the layman, what they would see with the work that you were doing?
Yeah, sure thing. So there were a group of us on the field innovation team from FEMA, from the Naval Defense University, from Occupy Sandy, from Burning Man Infrastructure, all sorts of different groups of people at Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. And so we would walk around together and we would talk to people and we say, what are your needs? What is your experience like right now? And in trying to get them into a better place, we were able to see what the system level flaws were. And so the fact that one side of the street got the pamphlet saying where the disaster response center was, the DRC, but the other side didn't. And so seeing how do we map those things in the long run while also spreading the correct information. And so there was another situation of someone who needed a ultralight wheelchair in order to get out of their second floor home. They were in a wheelchair, but the elevator had gone out, and so we couldn't get them out. And the fact that they were still there indicated that there were some issues with how people were canvassing for medical needs. And so in getting them the wheelchair, we set up the proper channels, not only of discovery, but also of deployment of resources.
One of the reasons I ask you about that is we interviewed a couple of people who were had sort of from a journalism standpoint were able to deploy technology to sort of inform the reporting they were doing on the ground. to try to help people who are in sort of a disaster situation. In particular, we had an interview with someone from WNYC in New York, where they will take data that they were getting and sort of deploying it on a map to help people to see where the resources were, and sort of a way for the technology on the ground to sort of help them report what's going on and giving information to their listeners, to their readers, so they could use that in an emergency situation.
Cool. So that's a great example. We had a great time of working out of a friend's apartment in, Greenpoint? I'm not familiar with the neighborhoods of New York, but, and she was working on the Inner Occupy Sandy map of where people had stated their needs and then how people were responding to it. So it did some level of triage. And through our connections with Google Crisis Response, we were able to get that layer put on the official Google Crisis map. And so that was a really good way of both building on situational awareness created by the people who were in the field, but also bringing awareness of how to help if that was your desire.
Yeah. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to call you is because you mentioned hackathons. You're going to have a DC Internet Freedom Hackathon. I think it's January 11th here in Washington, D.C. I participated in a hackathon a year or so ago. Could you sort of talk about what those events are like and what you're trying to accomplish?
Hackathons are work-focused events, mostly around technical challenges, where people of a varied skill set get together around a shared objective, and then they have a time limit on their production of something. I really like the open source approach of we're going to sprint on an existing code base, so you're not really starting anything from scratch. And this particular one is about taking a look at how a lot of crypto tools that we have are not very friendly for the user. You have to be pretty well entrenched in some nerd communities in order to be able to make it work. And so by looking more at the front end and how people use these tools, we hope that more folk will, which makes everyone safer.
So when you say make everyone safer, what does that mean?
It means having a level of privacy about the things that you're doing. And in the States, we're lucky that privacy just means privacy. But when you start to look at activism in other countries and the things that are built in one country might be used in another, your privacy and being discovered to have certain viewpoints or espouse certain ideals or be organizing in a certain way can definitely be an issue of safety and livelihood.
How did this hackathon come about? Was it part of something that you regularly do, just taking it to a different town, or is this, you know, something specific that you wanted to do based on things that are in the news right now, or things that are people interested in?
Yeah, so Geeks Without Bounds does a lot of hackathons. We do anywhere from 1 to 5 every month, and most of ours are around humanitarian and disaster response specific tools. We also do a lot of inclusivity hackathons, so we hold space for people who are queer and trans to feel safe in getting involved in the technical space if they haven't already gotten involved. And so we do those all over the world, mostly stateside, but also in places like Krakow, Poland, and in Dublin recently. And we helped with one that Digital Democracy did in Port-au-Prince in February. So we're used to doing hackathons. The specific focus on crypto is one that one of our employees, Leisha Sterling, who's amazing, has done some hackathons around in Scotland. But this specific one with OpenITP is because we really like OpenITP, and they wanted to do this event, and we've been hanging out with them a fair amount. One of their advisors is also an advisor for Geeks Without Bounds, who's named Ella. She's pretty great. And so it just made sense to do this.
You know, when we're talking about hacking and tools that are available for journalists, and just how important it is to, you know, there, you know, I've spoken to people who are interested in learning this type of thing so that they're able to, you know, better understand, open data, be able to incorporate things like that into their stories. From a journalist standpoint, what would you say are the types of tools that people should be looking for and skills they're looking to develop?
You don't have to be a completely into crypto in order to use the tools, but it's important to understand what level of security each tool is offering, because we often have this idea that if we use this one tool, or if there's the tiny lock in the upper left-hand corner of your browser, that everything is safe. And that's not the case. It has to be informed risk that people are taking on. And it's important that journalists use the tools that are usable both for them and the people that they're interacting with, but that are also as safe as can be. And that they have a deep enough understanding that they are able to notify the people that they're interviewing of the risks that they're undertaking. And it's up to the people who are being interviewed if that's a risk that they're willing to take. Often it is, but we have to be honest about it so that people know what they're getting themselves into.
Okay. And we're talking about, say, you want to interview somebody about something that may be, I don't want to say threatening, but that may put them at risk in some way. You know, they may lose their job. They may face some sort of repercussion for sharing information. So in situations like that, what are the things that the journalist and even the source, I guess, should be thinking about?
I don't want to make it sound too dire because then people won't do things.
Well, no, I mean, this is a really kind of an interesting time that we're in, that there's so much open data, there's so much open communication, but at the same time, we see incidences where, you know, there are repercussions for people, say, in the federal government who, you know, speak to a reporter and by repercussions, I mean, you know, they're disciplined or whatever. They may lose their job because they share something that they shouldn't have shared, or they spoke to somebody they shouldn't have been speaking to. And part of what we do as journalists is we try to find out the truth and try to develop sources. So it's kind of important that we do that in a trustworthy way, that we don't put our sources unduly at risk, I guess. I guess that's the,
yeah.
That's sort of the conversation I'm thinking about.
I mean, one of okay. So this is the best thing that I can suggest is going on long walks and not bringing any devices with you. Honestly, the thing that we have had driven home severely in things about the NSA is that it's not even the specific contents of a message that matter, which is what most of crypto is about. Mm-hmm. is wrapping that. It's about what's called traffic analysis, which is where you pay attention to who is sending what, where, when.
Mm-hmm.
If you have ongoing communications with someone that are friendly, and then every once in a while something else is slipped in, then that's less of a big deal. If you use something like Tor, which is great because the more people that use it, the faster it is. And if you want to support a Tor exit node without taking on the legal liability of that, you should support NoiseTor, which is out of NoiseBridge in San Francisco. They will run one for you as a nonprofit. But the more people that use that, then it's harder to do traffic analysis on what it is they're up to. But there's also... Strongbox has recently come out of, I think the New York Times is using, which is an anonymous way to drop files and things like that.
Okay. This is where I'm going to step out of the conversation and say, okay, what is Tor? For people who don't understand that, like
okay,
me.
Okay, so Tor stands for the Onion Router, T-O-R, and it's a way of, it wraps the packet that you're sending in a bunch of different layers. So as it finds its destination, it bounces around a lot more than it needs to, so that it's not clear where it came from. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
So and who are particularly using it? Is it are they companies? Are they nonprofits? Are they individuals?
Individuals. So if you run Tor on your laptop or on your computer or whatever else, you provide one of those points that packets can can bounce through.
Oh, interesting.
Because they're encrypted when they do that, it means that you don't know what's being passed through, which is good. The thing about an exit node is that, of course, then it has to understand what's in it and where it's going, which means that there's some liability at that stage. But it's one of those things of it has to hit critical mass before all the bouncing around is fast enough that we don't notice a huge delay. And so an activist using Tor in Syria has a hugely decreased time in their internet use. Like, it's just super slow because so few people are using Tor. And so by more of us using it and advocating its use, it means that it speeds up in general.
Now, when you say advocating a use, is there a sense of people against doing this sort of sharing, or
It's just an extra process in anything, right? And we're also spoiled that we think everything should work immediately for us. And we, I mean, now all of our web pages load so quickly that it's jarring when it doesn't immediately load. And when you accept that you're taking a slightly slower load time in order to help out this system, that's a cognitive choice. You're taking on a minor inconvenience on your part, and that's a big deal to some people. Some people don't want to do that.
Again, could you tell me where it is people can like support this?
Yeah, it's noisetor.net. Yeah. And they'll also have a better description of how Tor works. It is possible that I messed up some of the technical details just because it's been a long time since I've talked about that specifically.
Oh, okay. I'll be honest. I think we're a lot further in the weeds as far as crypto than I imagined we were, but that was probably my lack of not understanding the conversation I was going to get into. Again, sort of circling back to the journalism angle, your experience in hacking, in information sharing, what do you see as the trends and the concerns that are going on right now for journalists, for sharing information?
I don't focus on what's going on with journalism. I focus on what's going on with the technical side of things
Okay.
and how laws are affecting that group of people.
Okay, well then let's talk about that. What laws are in the US? What laws are affecting people?
The CFAA is the worst one, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Okay.
That is what Aaron Swartz was prosecuted under, is what Weave was prosecuted under. And it's basically setting that up such that when you click the agree to terms and services, terms of service, TOS, on iTunes, on any application, if you violate that in any way, you can be prosecuted under federal law. And that means that software companies are writing legislation, in short. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so they're not going through the normal legal process.
Okay.
They're not going through a thing, they're not going through our checks and balances system, anything else, which means that when Weave did the incrementing by one of the that he's now in prison for, of hey, if the registration of my iPad, if I increment that number by one on the website, I get the next iPad owner with all of their information. And when he went to Apple to let them know about that, they said, we don't want to know about it. So he blogged about it, and now he's in prison for doing math.
Why is that for sharing proprietary information?
Yeah. And for saying that, for doing something that is not allowed in the terms of service. And it's horrific, and that we on so many levels, like the law itself, the way the crimes are being defined is untenable. The amount of punishment is absurd, and it's affecting everyone. Like
Not just hackers, but anyone or everyone.
I mean, you also see this in people taking music, which we now have academic reports that and academic papers that say, if anything, pirating helps the music industry, or at least it helps the musicians themselves. It's that it damages the industry, and so and the because it kills the link. The people just have direct access if they want it, and there's not even solid evidence that it's damaging the music industry itself. And so all of these cases that have been brought against people for pirating or torrenting or whatever music and movies, there's no basis that for those cases. And they're also being charged with absurd amounts of money that ruin lives, and people just don't talk about it.
Sort of backtracking on this is we go back to the terms of service. I mean, you know, that's almost a mass stupidity, is because we all want whatever we want, but we don't read the terms of service, and so we sort of quietly acquiesce to whatever is put in front of us so that we can, you know, download this app or whatever. And, you know, so I guess in a sense, it's in many ways, it's on all of us, for not paying more attention to that and recognizing, that as a threat.
It's also that we don't have any other option. I mean, we have open source tools that are available to us, but it goes back to the Tor thing of there are sometimes minor inconveniences because it's an incomplete system that we are responsible for maintaining. And we want something that works beautifully. And something like Facebook, for most people to have a normal interaction and a normal social life, they have to be on that network. Like, you don't have a choice anymore. I'm not on it, but I am super privileged in the way that I connect to people in general. And so it's not even a we decide not to. It's that you have to decide on something else en masse.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then also, I mean, let's... Do you have thoughts about the way that Google is sort of acquiring everybody's information, and suddenly that, you know, now I'm on Google Plus, didn't know it, and suddenly all this other information I've got is tied to it? Is that concerning to you?
So concerning, yes. And it's.
I mean, on the one hand, it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. It makes this so much easier. But then, on the other hand, it's not so cool.
And it puts people again in physical danger where you suddenly have information exposed about yourself that you didn't want exposed. And maybe you have one crazy ex who now knows where you live, or maybe you have a government regime that now knows what you care about. And
what records you buy and what.
Yeah. And I have so many feels on this, but
I don't think we have that much time. Yeah. But what do you recommend to the average person then? What do they do to take their information back, to take more control of their experience online?
Use more open source tools, because many more people are looking at those and checking it, and then you have a group of people that are only accountable to themselves and not their stockholders, and accept that. Look at what it is you want to be doing, and then figure out the best way to get there. So is it, I want to have an easier way to communicate with my friends? Maybe having a persistent IRC channel is way better than everybody being on Google Plus. And so by taking a look at what the end point is and then determining the best way for all parties involved to get there, we have a more intentional way of building our new communities.
Okay. Well, I think that's probably a good place for us to end. Is there anything else you wanted to add about the hackathon coming up on the 11th?
I'm super excited about it. I think it's going to be great, and everyone should come.
Okay. Well, that's good. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, and enjoy Berlin.
Thank you. Cheers.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.